Top 100 Project
and action.
Hi everybody, and welcome to the Top 100 Project, the podcast that revisits the movies on the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 lists of the 123 greatest American films. Spoilers ahead! We're going to completely spoil this movie. I'm Ryan Ellis with my wife, Bev. Say hi, Bev.
Hi, Bev.
Okay, this week's movie is a classic and one of my favorites, It's a Wonderful Life. So the coming attractions trivia for this movie: who acts as the unofficial master of ceremonies during the "Let's all give George money" scene at the end of the movie?
I genuinely cannot remember this. Was it his brother?
No, because he comes in at the very end of the
scene. Yeah, I thought so. Is it Billy? Uncle Billy?
No, it's Ernie,
the taxi driver. Oh, it's Ernie, his bestie.
Yep. Ernie is the one who's calling all their names. That's the second part of this question. The bonus part of it was, describe at least two things people say to George when they drop money on the table.
Something like, I didn't need this $200 anyway. I can't remember.
One of the guys in the scene where they all want their money back, in the run on the bank scene.
Yeah.
And one of them says, another run on the bank. And then Violet isn't going to leave. I'm not going to go after all, George. Gives money back that he loaned her.
Oh, that's right.
And Annie, the maid, I've been saving this up for a divorce if and I ever get a husband. Which is, I never understood what she said. I put the subtitles on one time. It's just, what is that all about? But that's what she says. And the principal of the school, who we see much earlier in the movie, talks about, I had to get the faculty up out of bed. And then he gives Zuzu a little watch to play with. And Martini, I busted the jukebox too. Mr. Gower has made a run to my charge accounts. And there's other people, but anyway, there's about six or seven. Mm-hmm. So some of those are fun and some of them are funny, but some of them required subtitles to know what the hell they were saying. Anyway, motion picture number 34 in the Top 100 Project is It's a Wonderful Life. Populist director Frank Capra's most popular work was 11th on AFI's 1998 Top 100 list, between Movies About Movies, Singin' in the Rain, and Sunset Boulevard. But Wonderful Life got fewer votes in 2007 and ranked 20th, boo, between On the Waterfront and Chinatown. The film premiered in time for Christmas on December 20th, 1946, much like our podcast will be in time for Christmas.
Yes.
And that qualified it for the 1946 Academy Awards. Then RKO gave it a full release on January 7th, 1947. Despite its enormous fame today, Wonderful Life was a disappointment at the box office and certainly wasn't loved by the critical community either. Bev has the skinny on the film.
George Bailey, played by Jimmy Stewart, continually has his dreams of seeing the world dashed by responsibilities in his hometown, mostly to counterbalance jerk slumlord Mr. Potter, played by Lionel Barrymore. George has a financial crisis on Christmas Eve and wonders if everyone would have been better off if he'd never been born. An angel is sent from heaven to show him that exact timeline.
Or in a nutshell, locals aid delusional small business owner, then their contributions are made unnecessary by exorbitant loan offered by former resident. I always loved that part of the movie, that at the very end, Sam comes through with a $25,000 loan.
Way more than money than they need.
Three times more than he needs. Yeah. And it's almost like the rest of them should have said, well, I'll just take that money back then.
I know, why are they still
maybe
giving
I can
money?
Get a divorce if and if I ever get a husband.
Those people probably can't really afford to make those contributions. It's like Christmas Eve.
And Sam definitely does a great thing there because he has more than enough money.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful thing, but it's something that's been overlooked. I guess all their loans are unnecessary. Okay, we've all seen this movie many times, kind of like Wizard of Oz. It almost doesn't even need to be described. What do you think of the film as a whole?
I've always really liked this movie. It has somehow escaped my cold-hearted criticism of all things sentimental. I don't like sentimental things usually, but I remember, and I didn't even see this movie until I was in my 20s, I don't think. I remember renting it specifically because I couldn't believe I was in my 20s and I'd never seen it and people always talked about it. I didn't really expect to like it even still when I watched it, but I did. It won me over. I can't put my finger on what it is about it that rises above its extreme and unapologetic corniness. There is a real charm to it.
I think it's the darkness.
There is some real darkness.
The vision that Clarence shows him is pretty horrible. And the fact that he also in the vision doesn't even exist, that's a strange thing to get over right there.
Even that he's very seriously contemplating suicide. He's in a very serious pinch, and the stakes are really high. You know, I complained in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington that the stakes are way too low. There's something absolutely important about Bailey not giving up and not losing hope and not continuing to fight against Potter. Important not just to him, but important to his whole town, everybody he knows, and in a way, America. And we all know that's true because all the Baileys lost in, in the war for the world of finance,
and still are losing all the time. We've talked about this kind of stuff a lot on our podcast so far, about how these old movies in some ways are still, at least have themes that are still very current. And whenever it comes to financial situations and banking and the way that people treat other people when it, financially, that it's not better and it's probably much worse.
It seems like
the rules are stacked against all of us worse than they were even in 1946.
And they were trying to ring alarm bells back then and say, hey, you know, like, this is worth preserving. This community-minded finance is worth preserving, and it's what America is all about. If we take it away, then we're going to wind up living in Pottersville, which, I mean, Pottersville is a very interesting thing to talk about because it's strangely, you know, made to look sinister, but really there's like a lot of things about Potterville that look kind of fun.
It's hopping
and it's kind of it's really quite worldly. I mean, George is always complaining about how he never gets to leave this one horse town, this boring drab town where nothing ever happens, and meanwhile, you know, this place has a Pottersville has a bamboo room. It has all kinds of shows and stuff going on,
and Nick's bar, which was Martini's bar in reality. There's a black piano player. It's the first thing we see inside that bar.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I think, the very first character we see other than George and Clarence. Obviously, the problem is that people are so mean, almost. I mean, Nick is a real jerk, and there is no Martini, at least not owning that bar in the alternate universe. Violet is somebody who's gone over the edge of being... She looks like she's a prostitute, essentially. I know a big shot in this town. Does that mean that she slept with every big shot in this town? Maybe she has.
Yeah.
And Ernie is not with his wife anymore, and he seems kind of dark. And Ma and his mother has lost her husband and her son many years before, so she seems dark and angry. Mm-hmm. And so is George the only reason all those things didn't happen? I don't know. The whole point of the movie, obviously, is that one man's influence, or a woman, but in this case a man, can make all the difference for other people, especially in a small community, and especially for somebody who's always fighting the good fight against one man who is so selfish. And he's not that he necessarily would ruin the town, because as we said, Bedford Falls is still there. It's been renamed, and there's still a lot of things in it. It seems like it's more interracial. Like you said, it's more worldly, but it's not what he knows. There's a reviewer named Gary Camilla that he wrote in Salon in 2001, so that long ago, and I've read this review many times. And I'm going to quote a line here. He said, "I would just like to remind them of one little detail. In the real world, Potter won. We all live in Pottersville now. Bedford Falls is gone." And obviously there are many cases where that's not entirely true. Although I just thought of something here. In real life, for your birthday, we went away to Niagara-on-the-Lake, which is right near Niagara Falls, for those who have probably heard, at least heard of that place. And it's a quaint little town, but it is not—it's not literally owned, but it might as well be owned by one person who's extremely rich down there.
Oh, but it's
got a Bedford Falls quality, I thought.
Yeah, but it also has a Bedford Falls quality to lure tourists in. Like
it's a tourist trap.
Yeah, sure. It's not like Main Street USA in Disney World, but all the shops and the quaintness of the hotels and everything is all just meant to bring tourists in. There's a town like that actually near where I grew up called Kleinburg, and it's the same sort of thing. And every shop sells crafts and ice cream, but it's really just a front for tourists. It's not like the town was just like that because people who live there wanted to be that way. If it was a bedroom community or a town with some kind of industry, I'm sure that they would have big ugly box malls just like the rest of Ontario.
Well, then the irony, I guess, is that it's the facade, the front.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's been pointed out by other reviewers, including Rich Cohen. He also wrote this in Salon. I think it was many years after Camilla's review. But he says it's the most terrifying movie ever made. He suggested that Pottersville is what Bedford Falls really is. Only George's idealism makes it so he can't see it. He only sees it in the nice way that we see through most of the movie. And once he doesn't exist, he sees the truth.
I think I read that same review, and he points out that if everybody's true nature, as it's revealed in Pottersville, is to be nasty, to end their marriage, to be greedy and treat each other poorly, then what does that say about Bedford Falls? Is everybody just hanging on by a thread? Like, all it takes is for one man. And this is an insidious message in the movie, too. George Bailey, you can make a difference. You can save all these people. No pressure. You know, in that...
Don't you dare ever leave now that you've seen this vision.
I don't know if it's in... It must be in that same review that you just brought up, but at the end scene when he's hugging Zuzu and he has that happy look on his face, there's also terror in his eyes.
Some of the shots, he looks like he's like, what is going on here?
He's
going
to spend the rest of his life thinking if he fails, he's failed everybody. He's ruined this whole town. He's let everybody, like, sink into this miserable life this not so wonderful life.
The sequel. They're talking about making a sequel.
I saw that too.
That's become a fairly well-known story. Paramount owns the rights to the movie now, mm-hmm. and they're trying to block it, so let's hope that doesn't happen. But the storyline is supposed to be that one of the grandchildren, and not Zuzu's kid, because it'd be Auntie Zuzu, mm-hmm. is going to have to show the kid the error. I think it's a boy, the error of
Zuzu
his ways.
Zuzu is the guardian angel in this version.
Yeah, she's the youngest daughter in the movie, and the one that he's obviously the closest to. One thing, by the way, we're going to talk about influence at the end like we always do, but one thing I want to bring up right now, mentioning her, is that a lot of people have compared this movie to the movie came later, but the story of A Christmas Carol.
Oh, yeah, there's definite comparisons.
Obviously, comparisons there, and one of them would be Tiny Tim. Zuzu's not, almost dying of some bad disease, but she's sick when the movie starts, and mm-hmm. then, she's fine, a smidge of temperature. But she's kind of the Tiny Tim.
And he's the one that she's thinking of. Zuzu's petals are kind of...
his real connection to reality. Yeah, it's not just about his typical, what they call them, papers, I guess, his license and his insurance policy as well. But it's Zuzu's petals in his pocket. Like, I love
that's
that
the emotional connection.
They're not there either. What? Zuzu's petals. Mm-hmm. And the look
that's
on his face.
Really cool,
The look on Clarence, or on George's face when Clarence mm-hmm. Tells him what he knows what it is. Like, that can't be. But yeah, the movie is great. So many of us love it a lot. But there's an awful lot of things in it that are really dark. Jimmy Stewart got dark, though, after he came back from the war. He hadn't made a movie in 5 years. His last movie before this was 1941. This is 1946. And he was a guy who actually served in the military. You know, a lot of athletes and actors and other types of celebrities went into the wars, the various wars over the years. And I'm not disparaging what they did. A lot of them would just do a USO thing and they would try mm-hmm. to boost morale. That was their responsibility. There's nothing wrong with doing that. That's still giving up your life for your country for a little while.
Yeah, still giving up the money that you could be making in mm-hmm. Hollywood yep. and taking a break from that.
But Stewart actually was full-on blood and guts combat.
Wow.
And he came back a changed man. It was Lionel Barrymore, who we said played Mr. Potter, mm-hmm. Mr. the villain in this movie, but he was the one who convinced Stewart to do it. The Capra and Barrymore had to kind of cajole him a little bit, like, I'm not ready to make a movie, I'm all ready. And they said, maybe this would be good for you to do this. And it might mean something to people. But then after this film, Stewart made some fluffy movies along the way too. But most of the movies he made were the dark westerns he started making in the 50s. He made quite a few westerns starting in 1950. Winchester 73 was one of the more famous ones. And of course, the Hitchcock movies.
Well, we'll be seeing one of his darkest performances in Vertigo.
That'll be the last time we see him too. That'll be the darkest he ever gets. And yeah, that's a famous film for all the right reasons. But when it comes to casting Jimmy Stewart in that character, it was definitely against type. Mm-hmm. Even though he'd gotten darker in that part of his career. Funny thing is, he lived another 50 years after this movie came out, and he was already 38 years old when it came out, so he lived a long time. He died in 97, same year as Robert Mitchum. Now, we watched this movie on Blu-ray, and I bought the Blu-ray the day that we saw the movie. Mm-hmm. It was kind of a last-minute decision to say, I don't want to see the DVD again. It looks kind of tattered, and it was a $30 purchase that was well worth it. Did you not think so?
Oh, yeah. It looks wonderful.
Surprisingly
great print, yeah.
I didn't expect it to be as good as it was. I was impressed with the fact that I don't think there are any major problems with it at all.
No, it looks great.
And as a bit of a sidebar that Bev doesn't know, well, I told her that I did this, but she doesn't know my feelings on this. The Blu-ray includes the color version.
Yes, yes.
And a few days after we watched the movie together, I watched about 25 or 30 minutes of the color version. I wanted to see just how much of a sacrilege it would be, because Stewart and Capra both spoke strongly against not colorizing the movie. Stewart apparently spoke in front of Congress to not let them do this.
Wow.
And the movie was in the public domain for all those many years, because that's how people could air it so often on TV. That's how this movie, kind of like Wizard of Oz, got so popular and famous, is that it was airing on TV constantly. Wizard of Oz was owned by MGM and the later Warner Brothers, but Wonderful Life was just out there for anyone to air, and they all did, and then people would see it so often, and then they started really capturing it. Kind of like Citizen Kane wasn't really all that well regarded by critics until the French revived it, like we talked about in that podcast. About 10 years later, they brought that one back. This one took decades to really truly get to prominence, but it was colorized at one point by the various TV stations. I never saw that version. And I gotta say,
now
I'm gonna be building this up a long time, and I'll say, if it had been a color movie to begin with, I would have thought it was fine. I didn't think it was horrible. I'm not gonna watch that version, I don't think, again. It was an experiment. It was just trying to see what they did with it. And the colors were nice. I mean, I don't know how they do it exactly. It's probably a whole convoluted explanation of how they do that kind of thing, but I thought it looked tolerable. I don't want to see a movie that wasn't made in any other way. I don't want to watch a 4:3 version of a movie that's supposed to be widescreen. We're not going to watch Bridge on the River Kwai or Lawrence of Arabia in pan and scan. We don't have to, of course, but we're not even going to think about it. And I don't want to watch a movie that's supposed to be in black and white be in color. But I'm just saying that it could have been something that I just turned off after 2 minutes, and I was actually kind of interested in watching some of my favorite scenes in that kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
So it was tolerable at best.
Not sacrilege then.
Well, they shouldn't have done it. So that much is sacrilege. I mean, leave it alone. It's like, don't edit the movie later. Don't change 5 minutes of the movie. I don't like that part of the movie. Let's just cut that out. People always complain about the end of Psycho, where the psychiatrist explains what happened with Norman, why he was dressed up like his mother. Oh, spoiler alert. So nobody can go back and just cut that out because they don't like it. I mean, that's the movie, for good or bad.
Tell that to George Lucas and Steven Spielberg.
That's the difference, but those are their movies.
Sure.
I don't like that they did it either, but it's at least it's their movie. It's not someone else messing with it. Like if Capra said, I'm going to colorize this movie, and Stewart didn't like that, well, to a certain extent, it's not really any of his concern, is it?
I agree.
Now, as far as the title goes, I never was a fan of It's a Wonderful Life. The Greatest Gift, which is the name of the short story, is not much better, but it might have been a little better than this. I don't know what a better title would be, but
it really hits the nail on the head, just for anybody that didn't catch on. There's no subtlety in this movie, so why should the title have any subtlety?
Maybe they were playing off the notion that it was going to get dark, it was going to get difficult, and people wouldn't like that because that was not what Stewart was about. That's not what Capra had been about in all the movies he made. Another guy who saw some war. Capra was making propaganda films. John Huston was too. I think George Stevens also did that. So it's not like he avoided the war. He wasn't in the middle of it the way that Stewart was. But they both experienced that in a way that probably did change them in some ways. And neither of them, well, I shouldn't say neither of them, because Stewart went on to have hits in a different kind of way. Like I said, the Westerns. Hitchcock's films and some other things, but Capra didn't. This wasn't a hit, and this is the last movie he ever made that people truly revere.
I read a great another Salon piece that was published, I think, in 2007. They talked about Capra, and they talked about how Capra was an immigrant from Italy, and he really truly loved America. I mean, that's really obvious in all of his work. He's an incredibly patriotic man, and a patriot in the best kind of way, because immigrants make the best patriots. You know, they chose to be Americans. But the writer makes the argument that he was afraid for America, and that in a way he made this film as a warning, like, this is what we could become, just like we're saying about the comparison between Pottersville and Bedford Falls. He wanted to protect Bedford Falls, like, he wanted America to wake up and start behaving better, and he was worried, and he was right. America, it has become Pottersville. So as an artist, he was becoming more pessimistic. He was darker, you're right.
And that probably hurt the movie at the box office as much as anything, because Stewart and Capra's names would have still been gold. It would have been like, you know, Cruise in the height of his popularity, or Spielberg or someone like that.
And even though this was, without question, his most beloved popular film through the course of history, at the time it kind of ended his big Hollywood career.
Well, they created Liberty Pictures, and they only made two movies, both of them. He and I think George Stevens and William Wyler may have been the third one. They were going to make movies as a trio, and only two were ever made, both by Capra. This was one of them. Mm-hmm. But it was distributed by RKO. That's why I said at the top it's an RKO film. But all these things probably hurt the movie at the box office. I mean, there's no distinct explanation that I've ever found as to why people didn't go in the numbers to at least make it a moderate success. It wasn't a huge bomb, but it didn't do well. And part of the reason why is because it had to compete with The Best Years of Our Lives.
Which is also a pretty dark film.
But people, they embraced it immediately. The movie was released right around the same time, and it also had its premiere before Wonderful Life, so it beat it to the punch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people, Best Years of Our Lives was such a popular film. Enormous, enormous, and it kind of overshadowed.
This may not be a fair comparison, because Wonderful Life was regarded enough to get some recognition by awards bodies at the end of the year. It didn't win anything major, and of course, as we said, no one really saw it in the way that they would see Best Years and other big hits of that year. But here's the comparison I'll make. And Jurassic Park in 1993, when it came out, one of the biggest hits of all time after all these years, 20 years later, the last action hero was Schwarzenegger, who was still such a magnificently huge star. That was supposed to have been the hit of the summer. And everyone would have thought a Spielberg movie with dinosaurs still do well, but it just steamrolled Last Action Hero. And I don't know if the movie broke even or not, but the point is that it was up against it, and Jurassic Park was Best Years of Our Lives. The difference there being that no one really ever respected Last Action Hero. Even now, they don't.
There's probably a story like that just about every year.
As far as the structure of the film goes, it's a combination of flashback and dream sequence, which are two overused staples in modern movies, aren't they? And yet that's what it is. The very beginning of the movie is a bookend. You know, most of the movie is a flashback.
It's rarely done better than it's done in It's a Wonderful Life. They definitely pull it off.
Now, when we first see George, he's as a young boy. Now, I have a couple different trivia questions I'll throw at you right in a row.
Okay.
Because we haven't done one yet. It's been a while now. How old was Harry when he broke through the ice and drowned at the age of...
George was 12. Oh, I'm going to say 9.
He was 9.
Yes.
But on the tombstone it says 1911 to 1919. So he could be no more than 8. He might have only been 7.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
But Clarence is dumb, so there. Yes. So there's that.
They'd make that really clear in a catty way.
Yes. What is Clarence's last name?
Oh, shoot. I saw this written down, too. I'll never remember.
Oddbody.
Oddbody. What a great name.
And what are the boys riding down the small hill in that wintry scene we first meet George and his young friends?
I remember this. It's a shovel.
Yeah, they're all riding shovels.
That's a pretty neat little detail.
And somehow Harry's shovel goes about 40 feet further than anyone else's and he ends up in the water.
But I know.
How is he heavier than the rest of them and able to go further?
I don't know. That was originally supposed to be a scene of them playing hockey.
Yeah.
And it was this elaborate scene and Mr. Potter was in it. But I guess they wanted to cut it down for time and trim it. So they just made it sledding and cut Mr. Potter out.
Yeah. Since we went back to the beginning of the story by talking about George and Harry and their friends as kids, I think we should go back to another point I wanted to make, which is that George's dad, Peter, is in business with Billy, his brother.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that makes Peter a saint, too, to have ever gone into business with that man.
Like, give him a job that's menial, let him hang around, pay him a salary, but really, like, trusting him with anything is dumb. That's not saintly, that's just stupid. There's a point when they're looking for the money after Uncle Billy's lost the $8,000 where you just kind of want to shake George and be like, how did you ever entrust this imbecile with anything worth more than a stamp? You fool!
And when George at the beginning of the, not at the beginning of the movie, but early on in the movie after his father has died, and he's made that great speech to Potter, who, yet another character we see in the project, who's essentially a Bond villain. If he just shut up in that scene, George would have left, and the building alone would have gone under because no one would have been able to... Well, the board, they would have voted yes with Potter. But it's George's impassioned speech that keeps it going. But then it's when they're out in the main office, and then the doctor, who's part of the board, they want to keep it going, but you got to be in charge, George. Well, Uncle Billy, he's your man.
No. He would not just bankrupt
it. It would have lasted another week.
He would probably set it on fire. He would find a way to go to the pharmacist and, like poison that child after all. He's so stupid and incompetent. Why would you leave him in charge? I'm surprised they let him take care of a crow.
Yeah, he has a lot of animals when they show his house.
Oh, yeah,
later on.
That's right. He has all those creatures.
They're always animals in Capra's movies.
Because he's an imbecile. He was deprived of oxygen in the womb or something.
People always compare Tom Hanks, especially the mid-90s Tom Hanks, to Jimmy Stewart. Well, maybe Uncle Billy could have played Forrest Gump.
Yes.
Just lucking his way through life.
He's a little less charming than Forrest Gump was. At least Forrest Gump seemed to recognize his limitations in life.
Well, that's an actor we've seen many times in the project so far, Thomas Mitchell.
Mm-hmm.
He's been in four AFI movie so far with one more to go, and that will be High Noon. He has a small role in that one. And we've seen him in Gone with the Wind. We've seen him in, of course, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington with these same two main people, Stewart and Capra. And Jean Arthur could have played the female lead in this, too.
Oh, is that right?
She passed it down. So it could have been truly the same team in some of the major roles.
Ginger Rogers also turned down the role of Mary. Mm-hmm. She said it was too bland.
And Cary Grant was at one time supposed to have played George.
Oh, that's right.
And interestingly, it was Hitchcock that passed over Stewart for Cary Grant in North by Northwest because Stewart looked too old. Even though, as I've noted before, Stewart is 4 years younger than Cary Grant.
He does look older, though, in every way.
Well, there's even the line Peter Bailey has, the father has, when he says, "You were born older, George." Maybe that explains how he's 38 years old in this movie when he's supposed to be, I think, 20 or so at that point.
Yeah, he doesn't really pass as a pretty very convincing teenager when he's...
And that leads into one of the great moments in the movie, for sure, from the passion standpoint. When we get to the list, this will be on the top 100 passions. Is when they go to the dance. He goes with Harry to the little soiree, and he sees Mary
for the first time.
He's
as an adult,
yeah. He's doomed.
Yeah,
and I mean that in a good way.
She's beautiful.
Yeah.
She's an absolute knockout. The fact that he fights it as hard as he does, like their relationship, their courtship is very strange. I say this even though I think my favorite scene in the whole movie is the scene when they're walking home from the gymnasium and the clothes that they had to steal, and they're singing the song together, and they just have such a great chemistry. It's such a well-done scene between two actors. I really, really, really love that scene. But their courtship's very strange, and why a girl as beautiful as Mary is holding out for this guy that seems to pay her no attention. There's no way she's not being courted. It's also kind of ridiculous that in the alternate universe in Potterville, she's a spinster. Like, oh, if George Bailey hadn't taken pity on her, nobody would have wanted to marry
Sam Wainwright is interested in her in the regular universe, so why wouldn't she have maybe
done
that?
And if George never existed, she wouldn't have been hung up on him, and she probably would have gotten hung up on someone else. I say this every time I watch this movie, and I'll say it here. girl, you need some self-respect. You gotta make him work for it. She needs a copy of the rules stat. The way she behaves to get him, to, like, get her man, it's just, it's embarrassing. It's cringeworthy. The way she behaves after she comes home from school and they've been separated for a little while and he comes to call on her and she has, practically has this shrine set up to him. She's playing the song that they were singing.
Yeah.
She's, what has she done? Commissioned an artist to draw that caricature of him lassoing the moon?
It's a needle point, isn't it?
Is it a needle point?
I thought it was.
Oh, I'm so embarrassed for her. You don't have to try that hard. You're a knockout. And you're perfect. Like, she's perfect. It's the same flaw as Best Years of Our Lives. She is kind of a dull character. I know why Ginger Rogers didn't want to play her. She's so dull. There's nothing. All she is oppressively perfect.
Perfect mother later on.
Totally. Everything she does is ideal. And she looks beautiful. She's a fox.
The one time that Donna Reed won, or I think was even nominated for an Oscar, was when she played a prostitute in From Here to Eternity.
Really?
But Donna Reed in this was her, I don't know if it was her debut, but it was certainly her big breakout. And then she was in the Donna Reed Show, which I'm sure was incredibly wholesome. And then she played Miss Ellie on Dallas many years later. And, and Miss Ellie was kind of a bland character from Barbara Bel Geddes, too, who's also in Vertigo. But when Donna Reed played her, I remember I watched the show a lot back then. And just, I didn't know who Donna Reed was at the time. I'd never seen Wonderful Life. But it's just not very well played. And I guess they wrote it that way. But she's very bland. But I do love her in this movie. For one thing, because she's physically perfect. I mean,
she's beautiful. Great to look at. She's very, she's incredibly sweet. She has this great pathos, like... she's a very lovable character. It's not an unlikable thing to play. It's just a little bit dull, and I can understand why an actress who's used to playing much more vibrant, interesting characters would pass on the wife role, the girlfriend role.
Something else I want to add to that is during the scene where he finally admits that he's in love with her, Mary, hugs her close, as you pointed out, and he rubs his face right against her as hard as he can. And
one of those salon articles says that in that scene she went as far as to rub Spanish fly on her temples. He's compelled to rub his face so hard against
and
her.
And grasp her in his hands as hard as he can around the
arms. It's really quite forceful. It's not romantic at all.
Much like in Double Indemnity when they kiss. Yeah, people really like to grab
in
arms hard
40s,
back then.
It was, every kiss was like a beating.
But in that scene, I like the moment where they're on the phone with Sam, and Sam is trying to get them to go into business and buy stocks, buy shares of his stock, I should say. And before that, he's talking about some plant he's going to open in Rochester. The movie's set in New York State. Bedford Falls is supposed to be in New York State, apparently. Mm-hmm. It's never made clear. It's a made-up town, but it's set there. Rochester would be nearby, I guess. And even when George is angry about the fact that he's got to stay because Harry's going to be leaving with his wife now.
Mm-hmm.
So don't forget, that's happened that same night. He's got to stay in Bedford Falls after all. And he's angry because he's fighting his feelings about Mary. Even then, the guy who's always looking out for other people, why don't you open that up in Bedford Falls? Well, half the town was put to work when that plant was shut down. So he's still thinking about people in his town, even when he's messed up for other things.
Even though he's drawn away from it, that is a conflict in his character. He hates Bedford Falls, but he loves Bedford Falls. Mm-hmm. For somebody who hates his hometown as much as he does, and this is coming from somebody who hated my hometown growing up and left it, and I've got to tell you, I would never have fought to open a factory there. Do anything good for the... Sorry, people of Bolton, Ontario. But yeah, for someone who wants to get out of there so bad, he seems pretty attached to it. Like, his bitterness and disappointment and not being able to leave and go travel and go to college and go build buildings and live like a much more cosmopolitan life, it doesn't feel 100% sincere because of details like that. Like, maybe you're just meant to believe he always should, you know, the guardian angels looking out for him made sure he stayed in Bedford Falls because that's where he belonged and that's what was going to make him happy. And something that I always kind of found weird about it too is how quickly he gives up the notion that his little brother should take over the business. Like, why does his brother get to just get married and go work for his father-in-law? Why is his father-in-law's business better than the Bailey's savings and loan? I don't really understand it. And we know from watching Yankee Doodle Dandy that Buffalo is not a good place to go and live and raise kids. As we recall, Cohan's wife says, I know I could be an actress and a singer.
Even
if I am from Buffalo, you don't want to raise kids in Buffalo. I mean, how bad is Bedford Falls that Buffalo is something like, oh, I can't take away his dream of moving to Buffalo to work for his father-in-law. So I always kind of found that a little disingenuous that he so quickly gave up.
I think
up
it's
on
implied that.
That
this is Harry's opportunity to have a great life with the new wife, and with also in this other town. He's got to go to the other town to have that job.
It's pretty unfair of Harry to just create these other opportunities for himself.
But George is always looking out for Harry, right down to the very first time we ever see him as a little kid. He doesn't hesitate to dive into that water to save him, and then he gets the bad ear from that point on. He can't hear out of his left ear. If George could go back in time and change anything about his life, there's no way he would not do that again.
Oh, no.
So he's always looking out for Harry.
Yeah,
and actually,
one
other thing to remember is the last thing during the Dark Night of the Soul, the Pottersville sequence, that he encounters before he sees Mary. So it's the second to last thing that happens before he finally realizes, well, I gotta change this, is when he goes to the graveyard and he sees Harry's tomb.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like he's so proud of his brother who saved these men in war. And it's, that's a lie. Harry Bailey went to war. That's the first thing he says. Not Harry Bailey survived from when he was 9 years old and all that, but he went to war. He was a hero.
Mm-hmm.
No, Harry died. You weren't there to save Harry. And that's when it's like, where's Mary? Then gotta find Mary. And then, of course, that's the very end of the nightmare sequence when he runs away from that bar. Okay, another trivia question. Who punches George and whom does he punch on that night?
He punches Mr. Welch, right? His kid's teacher's husband.
Mm-hmm. No, he gets punched by.
He
Mr.
gets
Welch.
Punched by. Okay, so who does he punch?
Now, that happens in reality. And in the Pottersville dream sequence, he punches Bert the cop.
He does?
Get out of here, Bert. I'll hit you again. Get out of here.
His best friend. His other bestie.
And it's also disputed by many people whether or not Bert and Ernie, Bert the cop, Ernie the cab driver, are who Bert and Ernie from Sesame Street.
Is that even disputed? I thought
it is disputed.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because they're minor characters from a movie that wasn't exactly a hit, as we said, till many years later. And Sesame Street came along. Who's to say that Jim Henson loved this movie that much that he would have named them after two fairly minor characters, rather than, you know, George and Henry, as in Mr. Potter's first name, or George and Harry, even, you know, or something like that. If he loved this movie that much, then... So it's disputed, but people always want to say that that's what they're based on.
I always thought that they were, that was an indisputed fact.
It's a very disputed fact from what I've been reading.
Just an aside before we get away from this particular sequence, the second last thing he sees is that his brother died at the age of 9, but the worst fate imaginable is spinsterhood, as we all know. Look at her! She's wearing glasses! Take me back, Clarence! Take me back!
She's probably not even 30 at this point. She's given up on life altogether. Although I suppose back in those days, that was pretty old to not be married. But still, that's the sexism of that era. And it goes back to the beginning on the bridge. And oh, did you know something about that sequence? When Clarence says, you've never been born, that right then the snow stops. And then, of course, the wind blows the door open and all that. But the snow outside the window, you can see when they're inside that room getting dry, that the snow's been going down the whole time. Then it stops. And then when he goes back to the bridge at the end, it's, take me back. Please, God, let me live again. And as soon as he says, please, God, the snow starts
snowing
again. And then he's back
right in
reality. So, yes, he spends a little time on that bridge. Now, in honor of that, we have a sponsor. It's been a while since we've done a sponsor, but we have one today. Have you been suicidally depressed lately? Feeling so down that you think the world would be better off without you? Try Chuck It All, the pill for the man who's tired of fighting the town bully. No, folks, don't believe Dan Savage. It doesn't get better. So when alcohol only dulls your senses and that raging river just won't do the trick, take Chuck It All and be whisked away. Side effects may include hallucinations, hopeless anxiety, and angel sightings.
Finally, my suicide needs are met.
Well, mine are, from when the time comes. I'll be ready. But while we're making wisecracks, did you realize young George took advice from a smoking ad? Ask Dad, he knows, from a guy who's smoking.
Yeah, apparently there's a ton of smoking ads in that scene. They're all over the place.
And they smoke. I always find it weird when people like Jimmy Stewart, who's so revered by everybody, is smoking. He doesn't seem natural in it, like John Wayne did, or Bogart, of course, did. But they smoked back in those days. Almost everybody did.
Every time I see a movie made before the late 80s, I'm not surprised when people I want to see is anybody smoking.
But some people just don't look right smoking.
I guess.
Is what I'm saying there.
It's very wholesome, it's true.
And it's... Maybe one of the reasons that George hates the town so much is they only have one cab and one cop. It is a crummy one-horse town.
It is a crummy one-horse town.
Even in the nightmare vision, there's only one cab and one cop.
That's right. Even though they have like 5 nightclubs.
They need a lot of security.
They need a few more cabs, let's face it. I mean, he was a drunk driver. That's what happens when you don't have enough cabs in your town.
And as far as the Ernie and Pottersville sequence, is he a precursor to Travis Bickle? Can you imagine Ernie gunning down Potter and then some of the other bad guys to save Violet?
You talking to me? Well, geez, Ernie.
I was talking to you. You're dead. Also, we talked earlier about how, in George's nightmare sequence, about how the whole world seems to revolve around him, at least Bedford Falls does. Well, that's like a dream for an actor to play. The whole world revolves around you.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't know how solipsistic Jimmy Stewart was as an actor and as a human being, but if he was, then that must have been wonderful for him right there.
And that's another thing for George Bailey to come to terms with. After it's all said and done, everything I do affects everybody.
It's like playing Neo in The Matrix. It's
yes!
Like, I am everything to everyone.
Yes.
Now, here's a question, though, too, on a serious note. The scene where George meets with Potter, and Potter offers him a 3-year contract, but the building alone would be dissolved. I mean, Potter doesn't say that, but you know that's what would come of it. If George had accepted that, do you think that he would have kept him on as an employee and actually made use of him, or would he have let him fritter away, or would he have even just fired him because he got what he wanted? Is Potter really that sinister?
Yeah, I think he is. By the way, I looked up how much money that was worth. He offered him $20,000 a year. In today's dollars, it would have been worth $330,000 a year. Hmm. Like, certainly more than enough to solve all of his problems, all of his family's problems. A very, very tempting sum. But I can't imagine Potter actually treating him like a bona fide employee. He would have either made him miserable, punished him by forcing him to do kind of morally dubious things, kicking people out of their homes, doing all these things that are against his character, or he would have just let him crunch numbers somewhere in a corner for 3 years and then let him go as soon as he could afford to break his contract with him.
Yeah. So it's even an even more sinister thing in that, because Stewart plays the scene, and I'm sure it was written this way. It's kind of a cheese ball, though, that after he shakes hands with him, he's smiling, and I just shook hands with the devil. It must be kind of slimy.
It's one of the less subtle scenes in a movie full of things that hit you right on the head. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then he, of course, changes his mind rather. I don't need to think about it. Oh, doggone it. But it's one of those things, too. You think about what if George had accepted. It's an even darker premise with Potter than
He would have ruined him somehow, because Potter was one of those bad guys. It's not enough that he wins, everybody else has to lose. And I think he says something to that effect. To him, it's more about the competition, it's more about just trying to punish these people for challenging him than it is about getting that extra money that he doesn't need.
One of the times we see Potter at his worst would definitely be the run in the bank scene when George has just married Mary. I also love that you really see how heroic George is, because he's supposed to be going away on his honeymoon, and he gives up his own money. It's a beautiful little moment, because he's also protecting his business. I mean, his business is going to go under if he doesn't do this. So it's not just a matter of, well, here's I'm helping these people. He's helping himself as well. And by the way, trivia question, how much money does he loan out to people that day?
Oh, how much is left at the end is $2, right? So he lends out $1,998.
Yep, $2,000. Mm-hmm. The other thing I love about that sequence is Mrs. Davis, because they all ask for $20.
Oh,
then,
yeah.
And can I have $17.50? And she's so sincere.
Kisses her in the face.
I love that. It's one of my favorite most moments.
That, really adorable.
2 seconds is just beautiful little moment there.
A lot of good American optimism in that scene. If only small town people actually did behave like that. If only behaving like that could have saved the Bailey's Savings and Loans of America. I don't think that they could have.
Well, and there's an obvious tragedy in this movie that's happened in reality so many times, of a guy working that hard for so many years,
making
for decades,
those sacrifices,
and the threat of being not only having it not working, but of being ruined, of being scandalized and accused of stealing money because it was his dumb uncle gives the money away to the bad guy, of all things. And Mr. Potter's never punished. There's supposed to have been a sequence in the screenplay where right after you see Stewart run up the window, Merry Christmas, Mr. Potter, happy new to you in jail. And then that's the last we see of Potter at all in the movie. The last he's referenced in the movie either. Clarence is supposed to have shown up right at that moment to punish him for what he did to George.
So angels also punish people in this
that's
universe?
That's what I read. I don't know if they ever shot it, but
not only are they catty and mean and talk around the water cooler about how Clarence has been waiting 2 years for his wings.
They are kind of catty in heaven, aren't they? Especially the one guy.
I like how God, is it, who is it? Like God and Joseph are talking about sending Clarence down, and they're like,
Franklin and Joseph.
Is that right? But they talk about how he's stupid. They make fun of him. It's heaven. Is there one place in the world that somebody like Clarence won't be like teased and bullied? Not even heaven.
True. And he doesn't get his comeuppance, but I kind of like that, actually.
Well, it's accurate.
Because it's accurate.
He's, other than not reporting that he found the money, he's a pretty dastardly guy, but he didn't steal the money, and nothing else he does in the film is illegal.
Is illegal, which is what we see in
if
the
modern
banking.
If he wasn't practically twirling his mustache, he could easily be the banker, the responsible banker in Best Years of Our Lives.
Right. Yep.
He's just choosing not to make unsafe loans to people.
Yeah.
Again, the irony there of, like, look how much that's turned around. And the bankers, the evil bankers now, are making the unsafe loans to people who shouldn't be getting them, who shouldn't own their own home simply because they can't afford it.
The Ernie Bishops who drive a cab and get a loan that Mr. Potter objects to.
Yeah.
And maybe they can't pay it back. But George makes sure that he's going to be able to live, at least.
It does, like, rest all the blame on the inability of the lower middle class to own homes. It places all the blame on the bank. There's just a kind of oversimplification in both of those movies.
Okay, so let's quickly go over the supporting cast. We talked about the stars, Stewart and Donna Reed. She was only 25 when they made this movie, by the way. She was 13 years younger than old Jimmy.
She could have passed for younger. She looks amazing.
She's supposed to be 3 or 4 years younger than him anyway, but not maybe that much. Lionel Barrymore plays Potter, and he'd been in You Can't Take It With You, that Capra directed, and he was actually in a wheelchair, though, a lot of the movies he made at this point.
That right?
Yeah, he's in Key Largo, also in a wheelchair.
There's one other performer that was also in You Can't Take It With You, and was in every subsequent Frank Capra film. Do you know who it was?
The Crow.
It was The Crow! Mm-hmm. It's because I put quotation marks around performer, isn't it?
I knew that anyway.
Oh,
read
God.
That somewhere.
You know everything.
Henry Travers is the one who plays Clarence, and he was also in The Bells of St. Mary's, which is what's playing at the Hello Movie House! During the run at the end. Yeah. It's The Bells of St. Mary's, and great second feature. Kind of lame choices, but anyway, he's in that movie too. Mm-hmm. So how about that little tie-in? And he was almost 60 before he even hit Hollywood in 1933. He started acting that long ago, so he was a pretty old man by the time he did Wonderful Life. We said before, Ward Bond. This is yet another film for Mr. Ward Bond. Mm-hmm. He's in 7 AFIs. This is his 6th of 7. The Searchers is quite a ways away from now. That's his last one.
Yeah.
And this
he
played Bert. This is probably the most screen time he ever had in any of the
AFIs. Yeah, it's the most I've seen him speak in all the movies I've seen.
He's quick on the trigger in the Pottersville sequence when somebody punches him in the face. And he shoots into a crowd.
I know,
irresponsible
true.
Cop.
Well, it's Pottersville.
And H.B. Warner, who played Mr. Gower, he has a small role in Sunset Boulevard, so we'll still see him one more time as plays himself, as does Buster Keaton. There's other actors in the movie. We've gone over time as it is. But one more I definitely have to say, though, is Samuel Hinds, I guess is how you say his name. He plays Peter, and I really like the father's performance. The way that he doesn't strong-arm George into staying in the town, the way that everyone else, whether they mean to or not, does.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not in the movie for very long, but he's like he's hovering in the movie the whole time. And it's almost like a Spider-Man thing, too, where his death impacts the main character so importantly.
Yeah.
And that sets the whole story in motion, really.
All four of those actors have such a great chemistry as a family. It's very believable. There's so much warmth. Mm-hmm. They really pull it off.
And there's some humor, too, and some fun in the movie. We haven't really talked about that. There's a little humor when they're all still alive and well.
Yeah.
And that's played well by everybody. Okay, so Frank Capra directed, I think we've made that pretty clear. This is his final of 3 AFIs, and he certainly is an iconic filmmaker. He wasn't a writer, but he did take credit on this one, which apparently caused some consternation with Francis Goodrich, Albert Hackett, and somebody named Joe Swirling. A lot of people I've never heard of got credit on this in the screenplay. They're based on Philip Van Doren Stern's short story, which apparently was made into some lengthy Christmas card, and Capra or someone saw that, so we should make that into a movie. It was one of those kinds of things. And Capra also produced it, so it was truly an auteuristic job by him. We haven't seen a lot of people, Chaplin-esque, who do 3, 4, 5 jobs in a movie in a while, but here we have one who did 3.
Oh, and speaking of tie-ins, you noticed when we were watching the movie that near the beginning, I think it's Ernie that's reading a paper, and the headline reads, Mr. Smith gets nomination.
Smith wins nomination. Yeah.
That's such a neat... You pointed that out. It's such a great, subtle little tie-in to Mr. Smith.
I read that online. But I didn't ever notice it before. I actually looked for it when we watched it recently.
It's a great little Easter egg anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know if the timelines would match up, though, because Mr. Smith is supposed to be contemporary, and that point of the movie would have been many years before.
Oh, forget it then. It's a terrible Easter egg.
Okay, so technically, the film had some things I definitely want to credit it with. Now, there's overlapping dialogue in this movie, quite a bit of it, and that's a, sort of a Hawks trait that we know he used so well. But it's also just hard to hear dialogue as well. There's sometimes, like when I burned through the color viewing for that 30 minutes or so, I actually threw on the subtitles too to listen to some of the dialogue in some scenes where there's a big crowd of people.
Mm.
And Capra catches that really well, that people are often crowded around each other and all talking. And if you were to actually just be, as a camera does, or as a moviegoer, is to be watching something like that, how would you discern what everyone's saying? It would be a big mess of... And he captures that, I think. There's also an innovation by the sound designers and the effects technicians. They found a way to create falling snow that didn't make a racket.
Yeah, that's right.
Before it had been painted cornflakes.
Mm-hmm.
And this was some kind of... Well, I guess it's some kind of the modern snow that we have now. And Dmitri Tiomkin wrote the music, which I thought sometimes was pretty well done. I love the music cue, especially the sequence where George has seen a few nightmare things in the Pottersville sequence, and he says, "Who are you?" to Clarence. And there's like a really sinister music cue, almost like a horror movie cue. I really like that moment in there.
This was the last time they worked together because Capra cut his score out of a couple of scenes that he had written music for.
Made him mad.
Just because he thought it was better without any music at all. And Tiomkin was upset about that and refused to ever work with him again.
Well, how about that? We will say his name a few more times. High Noon, very famously, the score for that one.
Mm-hmm.
And Giant with George Stevens. And he had worked on Capra's previous AFI, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. All right, so some influence. We all know this movie is influential on many movies. Let me just list a few if you haven't thought of them for yourself already. There's Gremlins, because there's the whole perfect little main street in Gremlins that gets torn apart by these crazy little, jerks. And Back to the Future
has
similar.
Back
to
the Future 2 is the real the real homage. It's now, having seen It's a Wonderful Life a few times, it's really quite blatant, the homage in Back to the Future 2, the alternate future, or the alternate present.
Right. The Family Man, the whole thing. Mm-hmm. This is just a glimpse that Don Cheadle offers to Nicolas Cage. And Ed Zwick's production company is Bedford Falls. So obviously he's a gigantic fan. Edward Zwick did Glory and Courage Under Fire and produced Shakespeare in Love. We already talked about The Christmas Carol having some similarities as well. We won't dwell on that for long, but people who are fans of both movies probably know what we're talking about anyway. And one I thought of when I was taking notes, The Truman Show. Because here's a guy who wants to be anywhere other than where he is. He's constantly being held back. Now, in Truman Show, he's literally being kept by these people, but wants to get away. And at the end, of course, spoiler alert for Truman Show, does.
It's also one of those things that a great many sitcoms and cartoons, it's one of those movies that's been, it's been homaged over and over again. People love to use this motif, and they love to just directly reference It's a Wonderful Life, put all those little details in it
Married
to make
with Children
it clear.
Did it, of all shows. Married with Children did it one time where he has a vision, and his Clarence is Sam Kinison, the foul-mouth comic, who isn't foul-mouth on TV. But, there you go.
Just like in The Simpsons, it's Colonel Klink, right?
Homer!
And then everybody's life is better.
I resent these comparisons to what happened in my film, my favorite film of my own.
It'd be funny if Clarence had visited Uncle Billy and shown him what the world would be like if he had never been born.
Better.
It's like, oh my god, look! Everybody's rich. There's no small animals in the savings and loan. They've made millions.
Nobody's handing money away to the villain of the whole thing.
I know.
Stupidly, and then forgetting mere seconds later what happened to the money. Where could it possibly have gone to when you were holding it just before you got to the teller? Oh, good belly. Thomas Mitchell is at least a good actor. All right, so the awards and other AFI lists is a pretty good one. So, nominated for the 5 Oscars, including Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Actor. I said last week when Best Years of Our Lives that I thought Stewart should have won over March, and I, of course, still think that.
I disagree. I'm in Team March. Yeah.
Wow.
I just am not as big a fan of Jimmy Stewart as you are. He overdoes
I think it's,
it.
Yeah, but that's the script, though. I think most of it.
It's him in every movie, though. He's in every movie I've seen.
He's given a more complicated role. He's central to the whole movie, unlike March. He's one third of the movie.
He assaults Donna Reed's face with his face. It's very believable.
All right, so Russell Shearman and the RKO Sound Department got a special Oscar for their stunt snow, which we talked about already. And it took a year, but the National Film Registry is recognizing it since 1990. They didn't put it in the very first group in 1989. Here are the AFI lists, and I love these rankings because they're all very high. Mr. Potter ranks 6th as a bad guy on the top 100 heroes and villains list, while George Bailey was the 9th best hero on the same list. It was 8th on the top 100 passions, which is a little surprising to be that high, but there you go.
You saw the face rubbing. It's pretty passionate.
Yeah, it's pretty passionate, yeah. Oh, my. And it was 3rd in the fantasy category of the top 100 genres list. And here we go. Number 1 on the top 100, Cheers.
Oh, wow.
Most inspirational
number
movie
one.
For people. Yeah, it's one of the more recent lists they did, too. Top 100, Cheers.
I can't say it's a bad choice. It is pretty heartwarming and inspirational. Very all-American inspirational, too.
All right, so last trivia question.
All right.
And we see it at the very end of the movie when somehow it gets on the table full of money.
Mm-hmm.
The book that Clarence supposedly has given to George, what book is it? Remember, George, no man is a failure who has friends. P.S. Thanks for the wings. Love, Clarence.
I remember
what
that.
Book is it?
I think it's... Is it Huck Finn?
Close.
What is
the
it?
The Adventures of Tom Sawyer.
Ah! It was Twain, anyway.
Or if you're Rush, Tom Sawyer. All right, that was an extremely long podcast.
Well, it's chock full of wisecracks.
Let's hope so.
So
we don't take this movie too seriously. I thought we were going to be wisecrackier than we were, actually. But I worship this movie. I've mentioned it before. It's one of my four or five favorites. I've seen it every single Christmas for many years now. Even though we're in the middle of December right now, I might watch it again one more time on Christmas Eve or bouts thereof, even if it's just some of my favorite sequences of the film. And I'll definitely be watching it next year on the brand new Blu-ray.
I'm not as big a fan of this movie as you are, and I'm not really as bothered that it got lowered on the list, but I'd be very disappointed if a top 100 list came out and it wasn't on it. It's a corny, sentimental film, which means that I'm not naturally inclined to like it, but I do. Very, very charming movie. I may not watch it with you every year, but this is definitely not the last time I'll be viewing this film.
Well, then I can cry by myself.
Yes, knock yourself out.
I'd rather cry alone. Okay, so as we get close to the end of the year, we've only got a few more of these to go before the end of 2013. Up next on the Top 100 Project is our second look at Humphrey Bogart in a John Huston picture and our third bogey flick since mid-October, The Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
You have been talking this one up a lot.
Almost as much as Double Indemnity. Mm-hmm. It's a mean film, too, but in a good way. So the coming attractions trivia question for The Treasure of the Sierra Madre. John Huston won Oscars for writing and directing this film. Who was the next person to win those same two trophies for an AFI film? I think there might be three or even four men who did it in the entire AFI list who won Oscars for writing and directing. But who is the next guy who did it after Mr. Huston?
So for the answer to that question, tune in next week to the Top 100 Project for The Treasure of the Sierra Madre. In the meantime, if you just can't wait that long to get more from Ryan and me, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. You can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. If you'd like to let us know what you think of these movies, we would love to hear from you. Please shoot us an email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com.
Merry Christmas, everybody! And a Happy New Year! What happened to that money? Who cares? I got a loan from Sam. The money? Screw it. But Merry Christmas!
And cut.